This podcast is brought to you by Watch City Research, your user research partner. Check out watchcityresearch.com for insightful blog posts and to learn more about our UX research services. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 97 UX Things podcast. Dan Berlin here, your host and book editor. I'm joined this week by Amanda Rotundo, who wrote the chapter Ask Participants to Tell You What You Don't Know to Ask. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for joining the podcast. Can you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. I am a user experience researcher in the Boston area. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I'm excited to be here.
Excellent. Yeah, tell us about your UX journey, how you discovered UX, and how you wound up where you are today.
I kind of discovered UX as UX discovered itself back in the 90s. I was in undergrad, and I came across the concept of hypertext fiction, which was brand new at the time. And it led me to realize what could be when online experiences were user-driven and how that was so different from, you know, it was essentially brochureware, and sort of lit the path for me that wow, there's so much more we can do with this technology. So when I graduated, I got a job, information architecture, of course, and did that for a while and wanted to learn more about the way that what I was doing and the media I was putting out there affected people. So I ended up getting a master's in media effects from Penn State, and then went back to UX research independently and was doing UX research and design. But really, during grad school, I fell in love with research. And I did that for a while, and I kind of started teaching a bit to see if I wanted to maybe go the professor route, and I loved it. So I ended up going back for a PhD in human-computer interaction, and when I finished that, I did love teaching, but I also really missed just being in the field. So I continued with consulting.
Mm-hmm. Great. Are there any highlights from working on your PhD that we're sharing here?
For my dissertation, I studied the role of empathy in the success of design teams working at a distance. And this was started in 2009. So this was way before the pandemic, before, you know, non-co-located working was big really at all. And it was also before people were really talking about empathy. Now it's such a buzzword. And this was at a time where I had to explain to people what that meant.
Right.
So it was really new and really fun to be working. One of the things that my research didn't come up with this, but it did substantiate it further, is so when you have a group of people working remotely, so like now we would just say by Zoom, it can be very hard to establish, you know, team cohesion. And the one thing that was discovered at this point that has the biggest effect on team's success working together and enjoyability of each other being on the team is having had met in person one time. So yeah, and it's so funny because it's so simple, right? Like, you know, people are trying to think of all these very convoluted things of ways that they can build teams from afar and high tech this, etc. And really, you just have to meet in person one time, sort of prove the other is real, and then the relationship changes dramatically. I thought that was so powerful.
Yep, makes sense. You know, putting a real face to the name of the people that you're interacting with, and even just that one time, guess it makes a big deal, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, great. Thanks for that. Your chapter, Ask Participants to Tell You What You Don't Know to Ask. Can you tell us about that, please?
Sure. So this all boils down to asking one question. And that question is there anything you'd like to tell me that I haven't already asked? And it's kind of a strange question to ask, but I found it to be extremely powerful. And I sort of discovered it by accident. Hmm. I was working on this project for, I was in-house at the time, and it was for a company that was working to conglomerate various data across multiple online retailers. So we had an attribution system where we had a big team in India that was going through all of these individual pages of items for sale and giving, I think it was over 100 attributes about each one so that they could then be filtered and sorted. Mm-hmm. So it's a very intensive, very expensive operation. And what was happening is the data from the system was coming back an absolute disaster. It was a mess. There was a ton of incorrect data that was so weirdly incorrect that it didn't quite make sense that it would be, you know, a misunderstanding. So this fell on me to try to figure out. So we tested the system from just a, you know, is it functional perspective, and it was working fine. We did cross-cultural tests because we recognized that we developed the system for a different culture. So we did that. It was fine. We scheduled times to watch employees while they were doing these attribution exercises, and they were doing a perfectly good job, no problem. So we were just baffled. Like, what could possibly be so dramatically wrong? So in the end, we decided to, you know, well, it wasn't really in the end. It was sort of as we went along. We were interviewing people and talking to various people and trying to figure out where to go next. And one of the interviews I did toward the end was with somebody who was working the attribution system, just, you know, one of the people on the floor. And I was so frustrated at this point because we had tried so much and I couldn't figure this out. And I just sort of blurted out. I said, you know, is there anything I'm not asking you that you think I need to know? And it was such a weird thing. It just sort of came flying out of my mouth. And the participant just sort of froze for a second and, you know, kind of looked at me over Zoom, like, wow, you just went off script. And and then she said, well, maybe about the volume bonus. And I was just, what are you talking about? And so it turned out the floor managers were incentivized based on how many products had been attributed during their shift. Yep. So they were then prompted to further incentivize their teams to produce higher volume. So they had a sort of this very informal deal where it's like, hey, whoever attributes the most product on this shift, I'll give you $50. And it was this very casual, very, you know, sort of informal thing. And what it did was it totally upended the system and made it so the people inputting the data were far more driven to just fly through and get as many as they could versus any concern for quality.
Yep.
So once we discovered that, we realized, well, the problem isn't the system. The problem isn't, you know, the mechanics. The problem is the motivation. And we were able to get in and tweak that system, or tweak the informal system that had developed,
right,
and solve the problem.
That's super interesting. It speaks to a number of things. First off, how there are happy accidents when we are doing research, and when, you know, you have a question that just comes out like that, and it's a wonderful question. But it speaks to the fact that we don't necessarily know all of the things to ask when we go into an interview. And it allows allows the participant to guide us to the most important things.
Right. And, you know, one of the things I always think about with, you know, what makes somebody a good UX researcher, what's sort of at the pith of that. And I think one of the most crucial characteristics is humbleness. You have to recognize that, yeah, you might be the one who knows how to ask questions and you might be the one who knows how to analyze data, but you don't know anything about the product that you're working on. And you're talking to people who know everything about it. So, you know, being able to just say, look, I don't even know what to ask you, sometimes can result in some really great observations.
Yep. And it can come out, we can learn things that go beyond the things that we're thinking about. In your case, it's you were concentrating on the user interface itself, but it uncovered this business process problem, which, you know, user experience and business process are often intertwined. But it's interesting how that one question allowed you to uncover something that was not beyond the scope of what you were investigating, but an important tangent.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the time we're set up to go into these projects a little bit skewed because, you know, more often than not, when we go in to do usability research, user experience research, we're guided and sort of introduced to the project by the stakeholders who are most often, you know, higher up in the company. Maybe they don't even use the system. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had project owners who had never seen a screen. And so they're the ones really kind of framing the project up for us and telling us who to talk to and being the gatekeepers. And it's extremely common that the problem is something that they don't know to direct us to.
Yep. No, that's a great point. It allows us to not eliminate, but check our biases in terms of how we're approaching the research and rely on the participant to guide us.
Exactly. And even when the participants are stakeholders, right? So when you're doing stakeholder research at the beginning, a lot of times the stakeholders are, you know, they're existing within a power structure. They have a boss. The boss has an agenda. They have people who work for them that they need to protect in certain ways. There's so many politics, and they might not be empowered to speak out on certain issues or to, you know, really kind of say, hey, my boss is great, but, you know, she's not really guiding you in the right way. So by giving this opportunity in a, you know, one-on-one interview in a very sort of comfortable setting, it often lets that power dynamic kind of shimmy to the back a little bit and lets people speak a little more openly.
Yep. So I was really happy when you wanted to write this chapter, because that question is my favorite part of the research. You know, is there anything I didn't ask you today that you think is important for me to know? And it's so important or so useful outside of research too. I mean, we're always researching in our world, right? But when we're doing, as you said, when we're talking with stakeholders or we are chatting with colleagues, we don't know all the questions to ask. And I think people appreciate when we look to their perspective for what we should be thinking about.
Exactly. And there's two times when I'm out in the wild, you know, in my own personal life, where I realize, like, oh God, I'm a researcher. The first is when I ask a question and, like, you know, unbiased, I say to my kids, like, do you want to go out for ice cream or would you prefer not to go out for ice cream? Right. And then the second is when I bust this question out at the end of, you know, just regular interactions. And I do it because, like you said, there's so much value in it, you know, just in so many different situations.
Yep. And, you know, so I'm a UX consultant, always trying to sell business. And honestly, I always ask that question when scoping a project. It's because scoping a project is its own research project. And so look to the potential client to help guide me on the things I may not be, you know, thinking about.
Sure. I think that's a great question to ask at that point. And also, I think it clues your potential client into the fact that you are aware that you don't know everything. And you may stand out within their process as somebody who's truly curious and like I said, humble and, you know, really going to try to find the answers and not just present a shiny research report.
Yep. And I love what you said about, you know, keeping humble, because that's what we have to do as researchers, because we don't know everything by a long shot. And humbleness is what allows us to be curious, and being curious allows us to uncover deep insights.
Exactly.
So was there anything else from your chapter you were hoping to convey here today?
Are you asking me if there's anything that you didn't ask me that I want people to know?
Exactly. Well done.
You know, the one thing that when this question kind of came flying out of my mouth, I was surprised at myself, because it felt very uncontrolled, right? As a researcher, I think you're supposed to sort of, there's this idea that you're supposed to be very, very formal, very, you know, bullet pointy kind of.
Yep.
And this was not an instance of me doing that. This was not me playing that role. This was me being myself. And I think that to me was a very powerful observation too, that you have to be yourself when you're doing your research. First of all, because, you know, you kind of have to have faith in yourself that you're doing a good job. You know what you're doing. You've got the right instinct for this. And then second of all, just the extent to which participants recognize when you're being yourself and being genuine. And that makes a huge difference in how much they're willing to disclose to you.
Yeah, very well put. Have to be yourself. People and participants will sniff out acting pretty quickly and you know, clam up. If you're genuine, it's definitely going to go a long way to keep them comfortable.
Exactly. And every time I've tried, you know, early in my career, when I tried to be the formal fancy researcher, it's been a disaster.
Agreed. 100%. And it's a balance between, you know, regular everyday you versus what's in who you are in the lab. But you have to let that personality come through, that genuineness come through.
Exactly.
Great. Well, Amanda, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Absolutely. This has been fun. Thank you, Dan.
My guest today has been Amanda Rotundo, who wrote the chapter Ask Participants to Tell You What You Don't Know to Ask. You've been listening to the 97 UX Things podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. The 97 UX Things podcast is a companion to the book 97 Things Every UX Practitioner Should Know, published by O'Reilly, and all book royalties go to UX nonprofits. The theme music is Iron Lung by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, and I'm your host and book editor, Dan Berlin. Please remember to find the needs in your community and fill them with your best work. Thanks for listening.